Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is holding off on a self-imposed mid-August deadline to fire four ballistic missiles near the U.S. territory of Guam, according to state news media. The decision appears to be a ratcheting down of tensions between the U.S., Pyongyang, and comes days after President Trump threatened to unleash fire and fury on North Korea. Joining us in the studio, history professor and director of the Institute for Korean Studies at The Ohio State University, Mitch Lerner. Mitch, welcome back to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone is Guam resident and former WOSU employee Sarah Granger Homschild. Sarah's husband is in the Navy stationed on Guam. Sarah, nice to have you here.
Hi, Gail. Thank you so much.
And I know that it's not the greatest time in the time difference, so we appreciate you talking with us by phone today.
Yeah, no problem. It is midnight, so I'm a night owl.
Good. Can you explain, you know, what it's like there in Guam now, the current mood, how you feel?
Yeah, everyone is obviously concerned about the rhetoric that's been going around. But honestly, everybody's been pretty calm here. Been business as usual. Everyone's just been going about their day-to-day. It does seem to most of us that people back home are more concerned, honestly, than those of us who are actually here seem to be. It's been concerning, and we've been watching the news and paying attention, but our lives haven't really stopped.
Well, do you notice people talking about it more than usual? Even though they're going about their lives, is this a big subject of conversation?
Yeah, definitely. People are talking about it. People have the news on maybe a little more frequently or checking their phones a little more frequently than they normally would just to see what's going on. It's not stopping life. It's just kind of the soundtrack to it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Guam. How big is it? Population? I know the big, you know, U.S. military presence there.
Yeah, the population is about 160,000 people, and there are two major military bases here, so there's a lot of military presence, and the other big economic driver here is tourism. There's a lot of Japanese tourists and other Asian tourists that come here pretty regularly, so there's a lot of hotels and people going to the beach. There's a lot of coral reefs out here that are beautiful, so there's some marine biology work happening. It's really a special place, but it is very small, and proportionally speaking, there's a lot of military activity.
Well, since it is a big tourism spot, have you noticed a drop in tourism, or has Guam mentioned a drop in tourism because of the threats from North Korea?
Not really anything that's been noticeable, probably because most of the tourists here are from like South Korea or Japan. So for them, it's honestly they're farther away from North Korea here than they would be back home. Everyone's been still coming and the beaches are still full. So there hasn't really been a significant change that we've seen.
Because there is a large military presence on the island, has anything changed in the number of personnel? Have you noticed or has your husband told you that they've brought in more military?
I don't know the answer to that. I haven't noticed a change. But again, I don't know that information.
So has the government told folks anything different about how they should prepare for any kind of attack? Have they launched any sort of advertising campaign or any sort of way to get information to residents?
Yeah, the Guam Department of Homeland Security a couple of days ago released a few fact sheets about all sorts of emergency procedures, but one of them was in case of a nuclear attack, and it told us things to do if you're caught outside and the blast happens and things to avoid, like not to look at the fireball and don't use conditioner, because apparently if you use conditioner, it'll like bind the radioactive particles to your hair. And then they've been encouraging everyone to just have like an emergency plan with their families, have water jugs and non-perishable foods, similar to what you do for a typhoon. But it hasn't been a huge difference in terms of what the government's been telling us, like regarding the threat level. They've been pretty regularly updating us with Facebook postings, just saying that the threat level hasn't changed.
So you're from Ohio and you're in Guam. I mean, how are you personally handling this?
Yeah, I'm handling it fine. I really like living out here. It's a fun island. My mom is freaking out.
I was going to say, I'll bet family members are probably not handling it as well as you are.
Yeah, my phone has been going off constantly with people who are worried, but and everyone out here has been dealing with that too. Our families are all really concerned, but it hasn't seemed to be really that big of a deal for the people who are actually here. So that's been interesting.
Well, Sarah, thank you. We appreciate you talking to us today, and you stay safe out there and enjoy.
Thanks.
Sarah Granger Holmstrild is a resident of the U.S. territory of Guam and a former WOSU employee, and her husband is in the Navy stationed there. So thanks, Sarah. You're listening to All Signs with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about the history and relationship between U.S. and North Korea amid mounting tensions over nuclear war. If there is a question or a comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. As I mentioned, Mitch Lerner is here, a history professor at The Ohio State University. Mitch, now to you, tensions between the U.S. and North Korea, nothing new. What is new, though, is the tough talk from the Trump administration. So what's your reaction to the change of strategy?
Well, it's interesting, and I'm not sure I would note that this is a change of strategy as much as it is a change in temperament. I think in terms of the practical aspects of the way each sides are handling things, there's not been a significant change. Trump came to office promising all sorts of change and promising that he would ratchet up tensions and pressures and would find a way to resolve this. The reality is North Korea is, as Victor Cha, one of the Bush administration advisors, once said, it's the land of no good options. And so the reality is he came into this problem with his hands tied behind his back a little bit. And so while there has been the ratcheting up of rhetoric, I don't know strategically that there's been all that much he can do differently, short of taking us to a war that no one really wants. With regard to your specific question about the rhetoric, it certainly isn't helpful. Now, we like to all think that cooler heads will prevail and the consequences of a military conflict in the Korean Peninsula would be so devastating that they're really unthinkable. And that hopefully each side knows that this war of words is just a war of words and won't become any sort of a war beyond that. Nevertheless, I don't think it's helpful. To the extent that there's been any change, one of the things that I noticed, and this was played a little bit in North Korean domestic propaganda, was that Donald Trump's statement wasn't simply that we're going to respond with fury and, you know, unprecedented power like the world has never seen before if North Korea attacks us. He actually linked it to threatening behavior, to that the idea that if North Korea continues to threaten us and continue to use language that he feels that they shouldn't, then they might face this powerful American retaliation. So that is a little bit more dramatic language than has usually been used in the past. And while I honestly don't think it will have much impact in the end, because I like to think that, again, cooler heads will prevail, it's certainly not helpful.
Well, at this point, the U.S. has been imposing economic sanctions for many years on North Korea to discourage that country from continuing its nuclear program. How have the sanctions worked in the past?
Yeah, they haven't. I mean, there's a short answer and a long answer. The long answer is they haven't worked. The U.N. has been imposing sanctions since 2006 when North Korea tested its first nuclear device. The problem is sanctions look good on paper, but in reality, when nobody wants to enforce them, they don't accomplish very much. So the most recent resolution passed through the UN, I think it's 2371, has been much ballyhooed. It's, you know, we read that it's going to cut one third of the North Korean export market by cutting it by about $1 billion, as there's now sanctions on coal and seafood products and other things. And the fact that this was passed by the UN Security Council 15-0 is actually a triumph of diplomacy and props to Ambassador Nikki Haley for putting it together. Nevertheless, I don't have much optimism about it. I don't see any reason why China is going to enforce these sanctions any more than they've enforced any of the previous sanctions. And if they do, which I don't expect, the problems become that, first of all, oil, which is maybe the one critical ingredient for North Korea, is not listed as one of the items being sanctioned. And beyond that, Russia kind of hovers over all of this. And even if China does enforce sanctions, which, again, I don't think that they will, most likely the trade will simply be picked up elsewhere, particularly in Russia. So I think that while this is certainly the best first step possible short of war, I can't say I'm very optimistic.
You mentioned China, and I know that President Trump has asked China to put more pressure on North Korea. What is the relationship like between North Korea and China?
So we could do an hour on this question alone, because there's a lot of disagreement between the Korea watchers like myself, even on this question. I think there's three schools of thought, and two of them get us to the same end point. And those two schools of thought are the people who say China can't help and China won't help. I fall in the school that says China simply can't help, that as much as we in the United States like to look at China as the solution, the reality is there's a long history of rivalry between the two nations. Their partnership is really a marriage of convenience. It benefits both sides, but there's not any real fraternal or ideological bond. And for everyone, particularly the president of the United States and his administration, that keeps championing the idea that China is the answer. I mean, it's not just this administration. This has gone back for decades. I honestly think we're going to look back at this someday as the greatest abdication of American responsibility of my generation, because the reality is we've sort of outsourced it to China when the only leverage China has is trade sanctions. But North Korea has worked pretty well without a lot of trade with China in the past. The Kim family doesn't really care if its people starve to death. And they are so involved in black market trade and other ways to generate revenue that I think even if China wanted to be involved, they really can't influence North Korea on something that is so dear to the heart of the North Korean government. Now, there are those who will disagree with me and say that China could sanction them and could be the critical player here, but that they won't for reasons of their own. And that's a valid argument as well. Now, I don't necessarily agree. But either way, it gets us to the same place, which is that China's not the answer. Now, there are those who argue that we can really turn the screws on China and through various trade sanctions and other steps force them to modify their behavior and put pressure on North Korea. I don't know that I see that. The Trump administration is sort of celebrating a little bit that last night China basically agreed to really clamp down in accordance with these UN sanctions. And it comes at a time when the Trump administration was threatening them with a sort of investigation into trade policies that might have led to a trade war. And the Trump administration is claiming that this is China backing down because they don't want a trade war with the United States. So now they're going to get on board. I'd be thrilled if that was the case, but the reality is that I don't see it. I see no reason to think that China's not going to do as they always have done, which is put a rubber stamp on this and agree in some superficial ways. But in reality, behind the scenes, they're likely to undercut the sanctions. And they do that partly because it's in their own interests in various ways. But even beyond that, I'm not sure that they can impact the North Korean nuclear program, even if they want to.
You said something about what we do with China or what the United States does or doesn't do will impact us. And you said something about for generations, we're going to look back and say this is something we should. What did you mean by that? And I'm not sure I'm voicing it the right way.
No, I know what you're saying. You know, this we think now of North Korea as this security threat. And we focus the American people focus on its missile threat and its nuclear development. And that's all legitimate and it's all absolutely true. But the reality is this is a rogue regime like we almost haven't seen since we go back to I'd go all the way back to Hitler and Stalin, or at least to sort of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. The legacy they have of prison camps, of starvation of their own people. They are involved in every aspect of the international weapons trade, biological weapons, missiles. They have links to Hamas and Hezbollah. They are one of the world's leading producers of opium and meth. They are one of the world's foremost producers of counterfeit American dollar bills. This has been going on for decades. And despite the rhetoric that the United States and its allies have been spitting out there really since the end of World War II, this never again, we've all sat by and watched as this sort of neo-fascist state has threatened to destabilize the world, killed millions of people, and has their finger in everything that we find abhorrent. And yet generations and administrations going back to Reagan and Bush and Clinton have basically spouted rhetoric about how this won't happen. And then they've outsourced it to China and never made the difficult decisions that might have been necessary to do something about this government.
Mitch Lerner, thank you. We're going to take a quick break and come back to the conversation in a moment. And for you to join that conversation, please give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides at WOSU.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. Tensions between the U.S. and North Korea appear to have eased slightly. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has decided to forego a self-imposed mid-August deadline to launch 4 missiles near the U.S. territory of Guam. The question of how to deal with North Korea, however, is not new to the Trump administration. Preventing the Kim dynasty from having a nuclear device has been an American priority since the Nixon era. We're taking a closer look at U.S.-North Korea relations, Pyongyang's missile program, and its long-term strategy. Still with us in the studio, history professor and director of the Institute for Korean Studies at The Ohio State University, Mitch Lerner. Mitch, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
And joining us by phone is the director of Hyundai Motor Korea Foundation Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars, James Person. James, pleasure to have you here on phone as well.
Thanks, Gail.
I want to start with just a statement about what's been going on lately. What do you make of Kim Jong-un's decision to delay the Guam missile strike, or at least this is what he says?
Well, I think he's trying to calm down a bit some of the rhetoric that has of late been escalating, in part because you have a U.S. president who seems to be borrowing language that is typically used by North Korean propagandists and rarely by U.S. presidents. And here I'm, of course, talking about the fire and fury comment and then the follow-up statement that, in fact, it wasn't strong enough or strong enough language. So the North Koreans seem to be trying to slow things down a little bit, lessen, reduce some of the tensions.
What is and I know this question is you can answer it for hours, but just a general history of the Kim dynasty.
Well, so the Kim family is not from the typical pedigree of Korean leaders. The Korean Peninsula, from going back thousands of years, was dominated by you had kings. You had then from 1910 to 1945 colonial rule by Japan. Really, with the support of the Soviet Union, Kim Il Sung, who came from a poor family that tended the tombs of wealthier Koreans. This guy had he went to Manchuria, fought against the Japanese for a number of years before fleeing to the Soviet Union, and returned to the Korean Peninsula with a Soviet ship, and with Soviet support accumulated his power. He established a dictatorship in North Korea over the years by slowly eliminating political pluralism, calling anyone who opposed his policies factionalists and purging them, until essentially his power was unassailable. In the mid-1960s, he created something called the Monolithic Ideological System, which essentially made the word of the sovereign, i.e. Kim Il-sung, absolute. He, from that period, began to groom his son, Kim Jong-il, for succession, something that China even criticized as a remnant of feudalism. And we are now today in the third of the Kim dynasty, as Kim Jong-un, the son of Kim Jong-il, is now in power. And in many ways, Kim Jong-un, rather, today is following many of the things from the Kim family playbook.
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of continuities to North Korean policies, and you can identify a lot of, some long-term, slow-moving trends, patterns that really originate from the worldview of Kim Il-sung, the founder of the regime, including this way of seeing the world as inherently predatory and malign, and this desire to one could even argue that the nuclear program there is a credible at least to their mind there is a credible defensive rationale that goes back generations. It's not the ambitions of this young, overweight kid who is determined to strike out at the U.S. or hit an island or a U.S. city. there is a deeper rationale to this that really goes back to the time of his grandfather. That, again, is tied to this worldview that, that sees the world as inherently predatory. In fact, I would even argue that the origins of the nuclear program can be tied to what the North Koreans perceived in the early 60s to be a display by the Soviets that demonstrated their lack of credibility as a patron ally, that the North Koreans determined that the Soviet extended deterrent or the Soviet nuclear umbrella was not credible, and they therefore needed to develop their own deterrence capability. And they've been, from the 60s, really trying to achieve that. And they're closer now than ever before.
Mitch, would you say that North Korea's international ambition then is to show its strength?
Well, of course. I mean, every nation state has the ambition of showing its strength. What makes this situation a little bit different, though, is a couple things. One, I think James has already touched on, and that's this sort of paranoid is maybe the wrong word, but it's this defensive sense that they've been attacked and had major ramifications from the West in the past. And so the lesson that they have taken, for whether it's the Libya example or the Iraq example, is that the best way to prevent another American attack is by possession of these nuclear weapons. But the other wild card here, and maybe I'm a little bit more hawkish than James is I think that there is also a sense that this could be used as an offensive threat with regard to South Korea. Not that I necessarily think that the North is going to launch a nuclear attack against the South, but I think it puts them in a stronger bargaining position. And if we look at North Korean tactics over the last decade or so, we often see them using the sort of the threatening club or even their provocative gestures as a first step towards negotiating, trading off something that they want inside South Korea. And what we're seeing, if we look at North Korean rhetoric right now, North Korean propaganda, even the testimony of North Korean defectors, there are those who are arguing that Kim doesn't really want this just for defensive purposes. He also wants a club to hold over the head of South Korea and start to sort of extend the influence of the North into the South in the hopes of eventually forming some sort of confederation or something else that puts the North in a better position vis-a-vis the South. So, I think that this is part of a, just as James says, it's part of a long-term effort to demonstrate strength and guarantee security. But because of the unique conditions on the peninsula itself and the long rivalry and the stated goal of all three members of the Kim dynasty to eventually reunify the peninsula, there's a in the back of Kim's mind is most likely the idea that he could use this as that sort of first step to really have an influence on the peninsula that his father and grandfather didn't have.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about the history and relationship between U.S. and North Korea amid mounting tensions over nuclear war last week. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513. James, what is life like today for the North Korean people?
Well, depends on where you live. For those who live in Pyongyang, which is the capital of the country, I mean, that you have a privileged existence. You have access to these wonderful theme parks that, you know, we see pictures of, and where the leader visits frequently. You have beautiful parks and apartment buildings. You travel outside of Pyongyang, and there's this abject poverty. You see more ox carts or on the road than you do vehicles. In fact, there are no vehicles in many places. The only vehicles that you do see are, for example, wood-burning trucks where they have these combustion engines. I mean, there's people sitting on the side of the road or sleeping on the side of the road. It's a depressing existence outside of the capital. But for those, you know, privileged enough to who are, you know, absolutely loyal to the regime, life is good in the capital.
So would you say that for most of the folks that live there, there is a loyalty to Kim Jong-un, or are they just fearful of their leader?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, they are, of course, restricted from outside information in many ways. They don't have regular access to Earth. In fact, most people don't have any access to the internet. They don't really, so they're misinformed, and the information that they do get from state television, from state radio, just again celebrates the achievements of the Kim family, and again talks about the Kim family sacrifices for the Korean people over the decades, and so there is likely, because of the effectiveness of the propaganda, a loyalty, but there is beyond doubt, there is also a fear that keeps people loyal.
And Mitch, you mentioned that it's a harsh regime.
Oh, God, yes. And James is absolutely right with regard to the extent to which outside information is restricted, travel is restricted. Mm-hmm. He talked about the benefits of living in the capital city, Pyongyang, and of course, it is far superior there than elsewhere, although it should be qualified to say that far superior there is still not very good. But it's worth noting that there is this sort of caste system. So if you are deemed part of the disloyal class or the wavering class, and this goes back generations, if your parents were not, your grandparents were not deemed loyal enough to the Kim family, you are essentially ostracized, banned from the city. And so while things are better in the capital than they are elsewhere, it's still the repression of civil liberties, the starvation, the poverty. I mean, it really is a somewhat Orwellian state, or at least the closest I think we have in the country at this point, in the world at this point.
James, what is the relationship like between the governments of North and South Korea? Is there a relationship?
At this point, there really is no relationship. You've had brief periods where you've had engagement. Starting from, for example, the early 1970s, there have been brief periods of dialogue. At this point, as far as we know, there is no contact between the two. You had a decade. The last progressive president of South Korea before the current president Moon Jae-in, a decade ago, you had two progressive presidents that really did try to improve relations with North Korea. They carried on a number of projects, including the creation of an industrial park in North Korea that was operated by, well, the workers were North Korean, the managers and the actual businesses that were investing were South Korean. You also had tours to a famous mountain region in North Korea. These were all suspended over the past decade. And you don't even have now the family reunions of divided families, which is a real shame.
It is sad.
It really is, because these people are aging and many of them are even unable to travel at this point. But President Moon, again, the current leader of South Korea, he really ran on a platform of improving relations with Pyongyang, regularizing these family reunions, and lessening tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
We're going to take a call. This is Antonio from Cincinnati. Antonio, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing?
Fine. What's your question, comment?
Well, my comment is I was sitting here listening, and I'm hearing how y'all are speaking so negative of North Korea. Like, y'all haven't spoke not one thing of positive that North Korea is doing for its people. Y'all haven't spoke negative about United States yet. Y'all haven't gave United States the totally view of what's really going on in the United States and how United States running a negative government. Y'all ran the same thing with Saddam when it came to nuclear weapons. Y'all said Saddam, as white as radio, TV, all the medias that outlet with information, y'all said the same thing about Saddam nuclear weapons, all of this nuclear stuff. He's traveling nuclear bombs. And then after y'all killed this man, y'all came out and said that it was a lie that they had all this nuclear stuff, and he never had weapon of mass destruction.
Okay, Antonio, we're going to stick to the Korea thing here. We appreciate your comment, but I think what maybe Antonio might be referring to James, is that the United States has remained technically at war with North Korea since the 50-53 Korean conflict, and it ended without a peace treaty.
That's a good save, Gail.
That's...
Yeah, maybe that's what he was getting at. James, I'll defer to you on the history, but just simply with regard to the quick phone call, I would note that the obvious difference with Saddam is that he didn't have these nuclear weapons or any of the other weapons that he's trying to bluster with. Kim Jong-un is proud of what he has and is overtly displaying it. So there's no question that he has them. And to even suggest that we're saying all of these bad things about North Korea, it just shows a complete unawareness of what actually is going on in North Korea, because there's lots of bad things to be said. James?
Well, and yes, you're absolutely right. We have, I mean, well, I would agree with everything Mitch just said. But yes, we are technically still at war with North Korea. There was an armistice agreement in place since 1953 that is not the same as a peace agreement. I just return to the Iraq case, though. What's fascinating, you know, I said earlier that in many ways that the nuclear program is influenced by their worldview. Well, they have certainly learned lessons, or what they perceive to be lessons, by looking at the experiences of other authoritarian regimes, and certainly Iraq is one of them, where you had a country with an unrealized nuclear program that was taken out, and then. More recently, this was alluded to, Libya, where you had a Gaddafi voluntarily abandoning his program in exchange for improved relations with the West, and yet NATO-backed rebels took him out a few years after that. The North Koreans look at these as lessons and say, well, this is the reason we're not going to give up our nuclear program. And Mitch is absolutely right. They have been flaunting this program, carrying out tests and of both nuclear devices, five so far, and to date, two intercontinental ballistic missiles.
And is this their way of showing strength, and not necessarily that they're going to act on it, but just to say, hey, we're here, don't mess with us?
Well, they're not suicidal. Yes, I absolutely agree with Mitch that they're also factoring in, you know, using this as leverage over South Korea. However, it is in many ways, you know, a deterrent. They are trying to, you know, they're not going to use it because they understand that if they were to use their weapons to attack either the U.S. or one of its allies, that it would lead to the destruction of the regime. And ultimately, this is an insurance policy for the Kim regime. That's how they perceive it.
James, thank you for being with us. James Person is the director of the Hyundai Motor Korea Foundation Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars. Thank you for your insight.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll continue our conversation in a moment. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. We're taking a closer look at U.S.-North Korea relations, Pyongyang's missile program, and Kim Jong-un's long-term strategy. Still with me, history professor and director of the Institute for Korean Studies at The Ohio State University, Mitch Lerner. And joining me by phone is a former senior advisor to the Secretary of Defense and former special assistant to the Secretary of the Navy, Mark Jacobson. Mark is an associate professor at the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and currently writing a book on the use of propaganda during the Korean War. Mark, welcome to the show.
Great, Gail. Thank you for having me today.
We appreciate you being here. We're going to start with South Korea's president. He offered a blunt rebuke to the Trump administration's possible military responses to the North, saying that no country should take military action on the Korean Peninsula without South Korea's government approval. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff going on here, but should South Korea be the deciding factor?
Absolutely. In fact, one of my criticisms of the Trump administration has been their willingness to make some fairly bellicose statements and talk about how the U.S. will handle this. The U.S. may have to launch a preemptive strike without clearly indicating that there have been consultations not just with South Koreans, but with the Japanese as well. After all, regardless of what one thinks about the wisdom of a preemptive attack, the folks who are going to be in the eye of the North Korean response are the tens of millions of South Koreans, especially those in Seoul and the surrounding areas. So whether it's politically or militarily, any sort of attack or war with the North Koreans, this is going to require an incredible amount of consultation with the South Koreans, and probably in almost every instance, the U.S. should defer to the wishes of the South Korean government on how to handle things.
Because there seems to be an escalation of words and threats, there is concern of war with North Korea. What would such a war look like, especially in the beginning?
Well, that's a difficult question. I would say one thing. At least in the last 24 hours, we've seen a ratcheting down of the rhetoric. There was a back and forth, however, with Secretary of Defense Mattis making some fairly clear statements that the United States would respond, and I hope I'm not overcharacterizing it, but would respond militarily to any sort of North Korean missile launch directed at the United States. The ambiguity was, do you mean directed at Guam or the continental U.S. Mm-hmm. or in the oceans near Guam? Guam, as the story was last week. But how would a war look like? I happen to think that the one constant here would be that any sort of conflict that involves open fighting between U.S. and Republic of Korea forces on one side and the North Koreans on the other side would rapidly escalate. And what I mean is that a U.S. preventive or preemptive strike against North Korean missile sites, ICBM sites, nuclear facilities, maybe that looks fairly surgical or somewhat what we're used to seeing in the Gulf, where you get these strikes on individual targets. But I think it rapidly escalates into something we haven't seen, frankly, since the Korean War of 1950 to 53 or the Second World War, where we're talking about pitched battles along front lines. We're talking about artillery and rockets being used on civilian on cities, maybe analogous to what was done during the Iraq War of the 80s, the war between the cities, the Iranians firing rockets at Baghdad, the Iraqis firing rockets at Tehran, but multiply that by 100 times. So, again, imagine the pictures from the Second World War of what Germany and Japan looked like at the end of the war. So I don't think there's a way to control or limit a conflict like this. And I think what you see is something that Americans, who even those who have paid attention to Afghanistan and Iraq, won't see as familiar, because the amount of destruction, the amount of firepower, the just the pitched battles are something that we haven't even seen during the last 16 years of the war.
Mitch, it's not a pretty picture.
No, it's a horrifying picture. Sorry, Mark. And Mark is absolutely right. And he hasn't even touched upon the fact that the North has about 5,000 tons of chemical and biological weapons. VX, sarin, anthrax. And even so, leaving that out of the equation, their conventional artillery, which is 30, 35 miles from the capital city of Seoul. I mean, there's no way to launch a strike that takes out everything that North Korea has in their retaliation. And that retaliation can be so devastating. And let's remember that it's not just there. I think it was Lindsey Graham who said, well, they'll be dying over there, not over here. Well, there's 30,000 American soldiers in South Korea. There's 50,000 plus American students and businessmen. And then there's more than that in Japan. And so the consequences of this are really terrifying.
I know we've been talking mostly about a strike against Guam, how South Korea, and Howard from Worthington, I know you've waited a while to ask this question militarily. What's your question? Hello, Howard?
Yeah.
Your question?
One of the things, I'm pretty well read up on the history and the governments of the insular territories that the United States has, and one of the things that hasn't been mentioned is immediately north of Guam is a U.S. territory called the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. And if North Korea is capable of hitting Guam, with a missile, it should be able to hit also the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. And I'm just wondering if anybody who lives in the Northern Mariana Islands is also scared, because it's also a U.S. territory.
It's close by, right. Howard, thank you. Mark, any opinion on that?
Yeah, I want to take Howard's question and turn it a little bit. What's been interesting is the reaction from Guam has not been the reaction of the U.S. media and the politicians here. In fact, in some of the articles written about the reaction of the people from Guam, despite the handing out of guides as to what to do in the event of a nuclear attack, has been relatively calm. People aren't that worried. I think it's important to understand, and I don't mean to be callous about this, but a non-nuclear missile strike near or on Guam or the Marianas, it's just the starting gun. It's really kind of irrelevant to the type of broader conflict that we're concerned about on the Korean Peninsula. And Mitch is absolutely right about this. I focused on the conventional, but this could escalate rapidly into an exchange of nuclear weapons. I mean, this is what what the concern is all about, that North Korea has nuclear weapons. The threat of North Korea is not, so to answer the question differently, the threat is not that they can launch a missile at the U.S. It's that a missile can be launched potentially with a nuclear warhead that's able to reenter the atmosphere and detonate on a U.S. target. I mean, they already can do this regionally. So Japan and South Korea, this has been a threat for a long time. But I find it highly unlikely that Kim Jong-un would waste a very precious resource, if they even have one, and it's unlikely they have one yet, and that is an ICBM with a nuclear warhead that has the ability to hit the U.S., I don't think they'd be wasting it on Guam or the Marianas.
It's interesting that you say that, because I know that has been one of those controversial things batted back and forth. What do they have? What don't they have, I suppose?
And there, I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's an important point here. The way I think this crisis was sort of self-inflicted, actually was self-inflicted. This all started when there was a leaked Defense Intelligence Agency report that suggested that North Korea had the ability to take a nuclear weapon, place it on a warhead, and then on an intercontinental ballistic missile, and possibly use it against the United States. And there had been has been testimony over the last several years that, well, it may take North Korea several years to get here. There was another estimate that said maybe 18 months. But what people are forgetting is the same information was provided in open congressional testimony by the Director of National Intelligence, former Senator Coates, back in May. And here's the other piece. There is conflicting information. I mean, I hope we all remember what happened in 2002 and 2003 when people were talking about the conflicting information about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Now, I'm not suggesting anyone's cooking the books here, but we have to understand that intelligence of that nature is inherently ambiguous, and the policymakers have to make their decisions in the face of ambiguity, and that's what we have here. We don't know. We certainly don't know publicly if the North Koreans.
You're absolutely right, Mark. And like I imagine you're getting the same emails from friends out on the West Coast that I am, asking if it's time to build a bomb
right.
shelter or sell their territory. The reality is that what was striking for me was how quick the intelligence community came to the conclusion that they had successfully miniaturized a warhead. Right? We had heard
Mitch, and I would say in this case, it wasn't there's disagreement
right.
amongst the different intelligence agencies.
Right. And even that overlooks the question of whether or not they have the heat shield and the other necessities for reentry. So we're not at the panic stage yet, at least with regard to them striking the United States with any sort of a nuclear missile. In fact, I'm not 1,000% convinced that they can hit the United States with even a conventional missile. Their tests, you know, if you extrapolate the data, it suggests that they can. But let's remember that, you know, this is literally rocket science, right? Well, you know, I forget to pick up my kids after school, and my wife says, "Well, come on, Mitch, this isn't rocket science." Well, this is literally rocket science, and this is a hard thing to do. The Japanese foreign minister about a decade ago said the safest place to be standing anywhere in the earth was the place where North Korea was targeting with their missiles, because they, you know, they shoot a lot off into the air, but they can't actually hit anything that they're intended to. So it's
right.
not panic time yet, and if cooler heads will prevail in Pyongyang and in the White House, hopefully we can ratchet things down and find a peaceful resolution.
Mark, I have an email from a listener, Frankie. He wants to know, why is it that after all these years, we haven't developed defenses that can reliably shoot down ICBMs so these missiles aren't a threat?
More rocket science. I mean, this is really hard. This is hitting a bullet with a bullet, to make it oversimplify it a bit. And here's the thing. The current U.S. missile defense capability, some of it on medium-range missiles, isn't that bad, but it's not perfect. In terms of our theater high area air defense system, I think that's sort of in the 80% range. But, of course, you know, look, only one has to get through. In terms of the national missile defense we're talking about, the testing that's been going on for years, I mean, and again, remember, this has its roots actually well before the Reagan Star Wars era. This goes back to the 1940s when people were thinking about how to deal with the German V-2 rockets. But we're talking about maybe a 50-50 proposition here. And one of the reasons people think that Kim Jong-un mentioned that he might send 4 rockets towards Guam was an attempt to swamp U.S. defense system. So again, the short answer, this is really difficult to do. However, this is why the strategy, when you're dealing with a country that has conventional or especially nuclear weapons, is not about shooting them down. It's about deterrence. In other words, you show the other side that you will make the cost of them using that weapon so incredibly high it's not worth using them, that you will be able to punish them several times over if they use those weapons. And again, this is the classic strategy we saw that worked during the Cold War, not perfectly, but we didn't have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. We certainly deter Russia and their potential use of nuclear weapons in the same way today, as well as China. One of the arguments, and I disagree with the White House and National Security Advisor McMaster on this. The White House doesn't believe North Korea can be deterred. I happen to think they can be deterred.
Because at this point, it doesn't – well, at this point, there aren't a lot, as Mitch said, good options. But how much power – and I think people want to know this – does the U.S. president have to launch a nuclear attack? What does he need to do? Does he need permission from anyone?
That's a difficult question. It's really the question of whether the president has the authority to go to war without Congress. And the short answer is yes, in many cases, the president does. During the Cold War, where you had at worst case, 6 to 8 minutes to respond to a Soviet attack launched where nuclear weapons were launched from submarines off the U.S. coast, to about 15 minutes, I believe, for Soviet land-based ICBMs with nuclear weapons from launch to impact. The notion was, well, the president, as commander-in-chief, has the authority to respond to an attack that started there, to an imminent attack without congressional authority. However, there's a very good argument that certainly in this case that we're not talking about an imminent threat or something where there's no ability of the president to consider actions or go to Congress. So, yes, in short, the president could launch nuclear weapons, but two things. First, where does Congress get in the way, and could they, depending on the timeline? And secondly, what would his Secretary of Defense and generals do in the event of the president ordering a launch in an unprovoked situation?
And then there's also, this is such a region of complexity, of complicated international relations, that you have to, one hopes that there are voices inside the White House saying South Korea needs to be consulted, Japan needs to be consulted, and that brings other voices into the dialogue. You mentioned earlier, Gail, and I thought a quick comment, but you mentioned earlier President Moon Jae-in's statement this morning about how the United States needed approval from South Korea before they launched a military response. And there's two different translations of that statement floating around, and one of them says not approval, but permission, says that the United States needs permission. And one can just imagine heads exploding in the White House as they're reading that they need permission.
Permission. Thank you both. We are out of time. I know we could talk about this for hours, and I appreciate your time, both of you. Mark Jacobson, former senior advisor to the Secretary of Defense and associate professor at the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Thank you, Mark.
My pleasure.
And Mitch Lerner, history professor and director of the Institute for Korean Studies at The Ohio State University. Thank you, Mitch, for being in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.